We now pick up on the second part of a Q&A with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on January 28, 2009, with Al Gore, the former vice president, who's well known for his views on climate change. You can find Al Gore's testimony and the first part of this Q&A in the Climate Solutions section of ecoshock.org.
Appreciate your leadership in this context and using the committee's jurisdiction to move this issue along. And Mr. Vice President, welcome again. Thank you for your incredible leadership. You make this crystalline for those who don't either understand it or want to understand it. And I appreciate your incredible advocacy in this respect. As you've well noted, the situation is grim. The challenge presents us with equally great opportunities for action. And I believe there are three things we need to do to get past the old rhetoric and get moving to address climate change. We've got to work through the fears that addressing climate change will hurt American competitiveness. We need to gather all the stakeholders, including business, labor, and the environmental community, and figure out the real data on how a carbon price will impact carbon-intensive industries. And once we have that data, we can address those impacts. And it's time to get past the rhetoric and get to a set of numbers we can all agree on. And there are several of us who are working on that. Second, if costs are a key concern, let's determine what the true costs of lowering greenhouse gas emissions are versus the costs of climate change impacts from unfettered emissions. And I think in Great Britain, they produced that Stern review, which stated if we don't act, the overall costs and risks of climate change will be equivalent to losing at least 5% of global GDP each year, now and forever. I think that's pretty dramatic. And third, we need the president and other leaders to prioritize climate change and raise awareness about the inevitable effects we will all feel as the climate continues to warm. So I want to join my voice to the chorus of voices that you have brought people to in this respect, as well as the chair. I have a couple of questions. First, particularly close to my heart is the devastation that will result from rising sea levels. In a report released just 2 days ago, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration noted that even conservative estimates could mean that, quote, many coastal and island features would ultimately become submerged. Mr. Vice President, submerged is a frightening word to states such as New Jersey that have 127 miles of incredibly important coastline that supports very complex ecosystems and are an integral part of so many people's lives. It is also a great part and driver of our economy as well, second largest driver of New Jersey's economy, and I'm sure many coastal states would find themselves in the same set of circumstances. So no one's better at raising awareness of climate impacts than you are, so first of all, I have an invitation. Will you join me this summer at the Jersey Shore so that, in fact, we can see firsthand the challenge that we have and the resources that would be put at risk if, in fact, we don't act and act quickly on global climate change?
Well, I love Jersey Shore.
I figured it was an easy one, you know.
Well, thank you for the invitation. We'll try to work that out.
Last September, you spoke along with fellow Nobel Peace Laureate Wangari Maathai about the importance of including forest preservation efforts in a carbon market. And a report by the Union of Concerned Scientists stated that if the international community invested a total of $5 billion annually, we would reduce emissions caused by clearing tropical forests by 20% in the year 2020, which would be the equivalent of taking 100 million cars off the road. Do you support the idea of addressing international deforestation and degradation through market mechanisms?
Yes, I definitely think that the problem of deforestation should be included in the treaty negotiated at Copenhagen, because more than 20% of the world's global warming pollution each year comes from deforestation. It used to be extremely difficult to put that in the same conversation with industrial emissions. But starting in the conference in Bali a year ago in December, the formula was pretty much agreed to, and I think everybody now has a high degree of confidence that this new treaty will include this element and will be included in the market mechanisms.
And do you think we can create the regulatory and enforcement capability to make such a market work effectively?
Yes, I do. And a lot of work's been done over the last several years to make that possible, and I think there's now a high degree of confidence in it.
Mr. Vice President, because of the recent financial scandals and the economic downturn, there has been by some an increasing distrust of market mechanisms. And I understand the skepticism of some, but I also believe that properly constructed markets, such as a cap-and-trade system, can be a powerful tool to lower emissions in an efficient manner. How would you respond to those who express doubt about creating a carbon market? And if we do create a cap-and-trade system, is there anything wrong with taking some of the auction revenues and using them for green energy research, making homes, for example, more energy efficient, and training workers for a green economy?
Well, I certainly agree with the last part of your comment. And I think your question is a very important and interesting one, Senator Menendez. Capitalism itself has been under attack in the wake of the synchronized global recession and the credit crisis that has now gripped the global economy. But we know from long experience that capitalism unlocks a higher fraction of the human potential than any other system. And when properly pursued with adequate and appropriate regulation to protect the public interest, it is by far the best way to proceed. Now, the most serious defect in the way capitalism has addressed this climate crisis up until now has been what the economic theorists call externalities, and meaning, of course, that the horrible consequences of dumping 70 million tons of CO2 into the Earth's atmosphere every 24 hours are not anywhere included in the market's calculation of the costs and benefits of energy choices and economic choices. If an individual or a business can simply dump the pollution on others and not have to reflect the cost of dealing with it adequately in the economics of what they're doing, then obviously if that's a free way to evade the responsibility for that cost, they're going to do it. And CO2 has been a particular challenge because, unlike most other forms of pollution, it's invisible, tasteless, and odorless. And it's evenly distributed globally. So the old aphorism, out of sight, out of mind, certainly applies. With the new recognition that this is by far the most serious challenge we've ever faced, the efforts to internalize those environmental costs so that they're not externalities is the prime challenge to remedy the problems that capitalism has experienced there. Rejecting a market mechanism as a part of the solution because one is, whoever it is, skeptical about the market is short-sighted if it doesn't take into account the dire problem with markets that has to be remedied by including it.
Well, thank you very much. I agree with you wholeheartedly. Again, I appreciate your leadership. Mr. Chairman, I've had the privilege in the last Congress of chairing our subcommittee that deals with international environmental agreements. In any way we can complement your work at the full committee, we're looking forward to doing that.
Well,
thank you again,
Senator. You've been a terrific leader on it, and we obviously need your continued input and look forward to working with you very, very closely. Senator Shaheen, finally.
Thank you. Mr. Vice President, thank you so much for being here and for everything that you've done to raise awareness about the challenges of global warming.
Thank you. I can't tell you how glad I am to say that phrase, Senator Shaheen.
Sounds good to me, too. In 2007, people in New Hampshire, 164 New Hampshire towns, passed a resolution calling on Congress and the President to act on climate change in ways to protect the U.S. economy and environment. It was a very impressive showing for New Hampshire, as I'm sure you appreciate. And as you have pointed out and others have echoed here, it's critical that the United States be a leader in the world. And it seems essential that if we're going to do that with the kind of credibility that we need to act domestically to address global warming here in the United States. And as you pointed out, President Obama has said that we need to do this, and he's indicated his support for a cap-and-trade approach. And Senator Corker talked about a carbon tax and returning the carbon tax to the people of the country. But do you have any comment on one of the proposals about a cap-and-trade approach, which would have the funds raised through the auction go back to taxpayers in some form through the payroll tax or other means?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that it is important to mitigate the impact of any such measure by returning revenues. I think that, as I said in response to earlier questions, there are many claimants for that potential pool of revenue, and the Senate and the House will have to sort that out. I do believe that a revenue-neutral CO2 tax is the simplest and best way to proceed. I've proposed it for 20 years and wasn't even attacked on it because it was seen as so implausible. I think it's more plausible now. I think there is somewhat more support for it, but I think it's still widely recognized as in the highest degree of political difficulty, and therefore there's a risk of making the best the enemy of the better. And I think, you know, it's not an accident that most every climate bill that's been introduced is based on cap and trade. Almost every national approach that has been undertaken is the same, although nations like Norway and Sweden, New Zealand, and others have adopted a CO2 tax, part of which is rebated. The provinces of Quebec and British Columbia have also enacted it, and others are actively considering it. So I don't think it should be ruled out just because it's politically difficult, and it could be coupled with cap and trade. But in the real world of the political pressures that this body faces today, I think it's more likely to expect that a cap and trade system, it will be the instrument of first choice.
Well, maybe I wasn't clear enough. What I'm suggesting is that the revenues generated from the auction in a cap and trade could, rather than all of them going to promote other renewable alternative energy
yes.
sources, to have either all or some percentage of them come back to taxpayers in some way as a way to help make the cap and trade
Absolutely.
More palatable for those opponents.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
My other question has to do with transmission. And obviously, one of the things we're going to have to do in this country, if we're really going to get where we need to go in terms of alternative and renewable energies, is to change our transmission system.
Right.
And one huge issue with respect to transmission is how the siting gets done and who has responsibility for that. Obviously, states have tended to hold on to that responsibility very jealously. Do you have thoughts about whether there should be a federal entity that takes responsibility for transmission siting, or whether there's a way to address the each state wanting to have control in a way that makes it so difficult to get any changes to the transmission system done?
I believe that our country needs a unified national smart grid with a large federal role, not to the complete elimination of state and regional roles, but we now have a balkanized system with three interconnected grids, one in the east, one in the west, one in Texas, and lots of smaller systems within each of the three. And, you know, utility economics is to economics roughly as quantum physics is to physics. The normal rules don't appear to apply. And so, for example, in many regions of the country, no matter the availability of renewables or conservation options, the utility is rewarded far greater for the dirtiest electrons that they can possibly provide. And if within that system they are given the authority to bring in new dirty coal-fired electricity to replace some of the renewables that are coming online, that would be a tragic result. So I think we need a unified national smart grid that places a priority on renewable electricity. And the new grid has roughly two components. One is the ability to transmit the power over long distances with low losses from the solar energies of the Southwest and the wind corridor in the mountain states, for example, to Manchester, New Hampshire, and other places where it's burned. Secondly, it has the ability to give consumers, homeowners, and business owners a much greater, more sophisticated degree of control over how they can eliminate the wasteful use of energy and save money at the same time they're reducing pollution.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Senator Sheehan. Senator Kaufman.
Mr. Vice President, I'm really glad to see you here.
I like that phrase also, Senator Kaufman, and happy that we've had a chance to work together for so many years.
Yeah. We haven't had a chance to talk recently, but I just tell you how impressed I am with what you've been doing on this issue. And you really feel the economic recovery bill is a step forward in terms of climate change?
I think that the House version of the bill, H.R. 1, is an excellent bill. There are a few minor changes, of course, that I think could usefully be made. But overall, I think that the President's proposal and the House iteration of the bill is really outstanding. Since you asked my opinion, I have not gotten the results of the late-night session on the Senate Finance Committee last night because I was coming here to testify. But I'm very concerned that the committee version would result in a complete screeching halt to any construction of solar facilities or wind facilities on a significant scale anywhere in the United States. And that would be a perverse outcome if that provision wasn't changed in the middle of the night or isn't changed on the Senate floor if it's still in the bill. Secondly, I think that the Senate legislation as it currently stands coming out of committee has a serious problem compared to the House bill in not applying the right conditionality to the state efficiency grants, particularly on this issue of decoupling. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, but, you know, California came up with a way to give the utilities a profit-making incentive to give the right priority to conservation and efficiency and renewable energy and not just sell more dirty electrons. And the House bill, as it came out of the House Commerce Committee and to the floor, has a terrific provision on this. And special interests are opposed to it, naturally. I don't know the reasons why that has been eliminated thus far in the Senate draft. But again, I know there are many people in the Senate who will be eager to get the right kind of provision when that bill comes to the floor and that it comes out of the conference committee.
And, you know, you've been incredibly articulate both on the scientific and the economic implications of climate change. But I also know in there lies a very good political mind. And I'm just trying to just tap into that for a second. Kind of, can you just talk a little bit about how we get the votes in the Senate to make all this happen, kind of how you put that together?
Well, I think that the road to Copenhagen has three steps to it. First of all, pass the green stimulus provisions of President Obama's recovery plan. And book the CO2 reductions that can come from that plan. Secondly, pass a cap and trade bill here in the Senate. Having laid the groundwork for the CO2 reductions that will come with the Green Recovery Program and the Unified National Smart Grid and the Renewables and Efficiency and Conservation, then the degree of difficulty in implementing a cap and trade system that's intelligently designed, I think, is far less. And then the third step is to go to Copenhagen behind President Obama's leadership and get a treaty that's ratified and allows the U.S. to lead the world again.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you build that coalition in Copenhagen, how the president should build that coalition in Copenhagen?
Well, I think that one of the real keys is firming up the willingness of the developing countries to undertake, the phrase is differentiated, but binding obligations in the first phase. If they were not subject to some binding obligations in the first phase, then we would once again face a political challenge here in the U.S., particularly when IT-empowered outsourcing creates new competitors in the developing world. So I think that their new willingness to accept differentiated but binding obligations is really one of the real keys to building that coalition. And those countries ought to understand that the ability of the United States and therefore the world community to deal with this crisis expeditiously and effectively really does depend on the willingness. Well, it depends on a lot of things, but one of them is the willingness of these developing countries to accept differentiated but binding obligations in the first phase.
And how do you think, just a little bit about the present recession, is affecting our ability to convince them to sign on to this?
Well, again, I believe that, you know, the old cliche is crisis is both danger and opportunity. I believe this is a tremendous opportunity to put a lot of people to work quickly in sustainable, high-paying jobs. And in the developing countries, you have certain opportunities there that don't exist here. Just as some of those countries leapfrogged over the old fixed-line telephone service and went straight to cell phones, some of them are going to skip over the old dirty coal-fired generating plants and go straight to solar and wind. And if you don't have all that existing legacy infrastructure, the economic advantages of renewables are even more pronounced. Also, tree planting programs, which along with avoided deforestation can result in the sequestering of a lot of CO2 from the atmosphere, that creates a lot of jobs in the developing countries. And one final point, we talked earlier in the committee about including prospectively soil carbon in the calculations. That can't happen in Copenhagen because the spade work hasn't been done to do the monitoring and compliance to a degree of reliability and satisfaction that will make it possible to do it this December. But we can start that process going just as the avoided deforestation was in previous meetings. And if we can include it, then in these poor countries that need better agricultural techniques and more income, soil carbon sequestration can be a very important new element prospectively in getting them integrated into the global economy.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Kaufman. Mr. Vice President, just picking up quickly on a couple of those thoughts. If indeed we can leapfrog, which I absolutely agree with you, this is a wonderful opportunity for people to avoid making the mistakes we made. There's been a lot of talk about the technology transfer, technical assistance, and adaptation and other components of this. Do you have a sense of how much we ought to be putting on the table in order to advance this conversation as rapidly as possible and to show our bona fides? I mean, it was my impression that if we put multiple of billions on the table as a mark of America's commitment to helping other countries to be able to do this in a way that doesn't repeat our mistakes, but at the same time doesn't handicap their economies and growth, that we advance this discussion much more rapidly.
Yeah, well, I think we should for a number of reasons. First of all, because a shared technology program and a large adaptation fund both are keys to gluing together a truly global agreement. But secondly, if we can kickstart a massive global shift from an energy infrastructure that depends on dirty and expensive carbon-based fuels to an infrastructure that is based on fuels that are free forever, the sun and the wind, geothermal, then there will be so many opportunities for business and sustainable growth and jobs creation for American companies marketing these new technologies all around the world. Everybody that is making these new systems will have all that they can handle and more. The supply chain bottlenecks will be the constraints, and then there will be innovation to get around those. But just as the United States led the world in the economic post-World War II economic boom, we can lead the world with our own job creation and higher living standards by leading this transition to a low-carbon economy. And technology sharing and adaptation support, those are two of the keys to kickstarting this revolution.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And as I look at the imperative that you so brilliantly laid out today and that the science is telling us requires quick action, as you measure that, the inclination is to, at least for those of us who have, you know, really hook, line, and sinker bought into the to that science, the inclination is to say, you know, why aren't we moving more rapidly with respect to that 100-mile zone that you've described? I mean, if you got 100 square miles,
yeah,
that if we properly developed it, we could be completely fossil fuel free in the production of our electricity for the United States, and then we move our automobiles more into the electric grid,
right,
where they're plugging in at night when you're producing the same amount of electricity. That's a revolution,
right,
in and of itself with respect to America's national security, the environment, our global climate change, our health, almost every obligation. So you say to yourself, why aren't we doing that?
Well, I think one reason is we don't presently have the infrastructure that makes it possible. That's why the first order of business is the approval and construction of this unified national smart grid.
But the question was raised earlier about the state set of restraints that we have, and the Obama administration has already met its own level of frustration as they've sought to try to accelerate the deployment of that grid, and we find, oh gosh, you know, you can't actually get the lines in here, or you can't do this. Does that require a preemption? Does that require, is that the first order of business here, to create that national structure that facilitates the deployment of that?
Yes, I think we need a national unified system with a large federal role, with preemption being used very carefully and in support primarily of the renewable electricity options. But yes, that's what we need. The introduction of the Internet kicked off a huge surge of economic growth and job creation. And people talk about the bubble and bust. Well, actually, the sustained long-term creation of jobs and income and economic activity as a result of the Internet and the software explosion that accompanied it and the personal computer explosion and all of the applications, it has been phenomenal. Similarly, the construction of the railroads in the 1800s, the building of the interstate highway system in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, these national unifying infrastructure projects were each accompanied by a wave of sustained economic growth and higher standards of living. The next wave will follow the building of the unified national smart grid. And yes, that in some cases will be the careful and judicious use of preemption with a careful eye toward not having it facilitate more dirty electrons, but put a priority on renewable electricity.
Well, I agree with you. And the reason I ask the question is that it strikes me that there has to be a greater level of urgency and focus on that central infrastructure component,
yeah,
from which so many other things will evolve. With respect to China, it also strikes me that we're staring at a unique opportunity. And I wonder if you agree that if the United States were to rapidly reach out to China and try to establish a joint venture effort on research on some of the technology transfer and even some of the technical assistance. And if we were to ahead of Copenhagen at a bilateral level, try to reach an understanding about our joint leadership role here. We're number one and two emitters in the world, together about 40%+, I believe, of all the greenhouse gas emissions. If we came to that agreement, it seems to me that would do an enormous amount to leverage what happens towards Copenhagen.
I couldn't agree with you more. And recent statements by Chinese leaders have made it very clear that they are changing and changing rapidly. Resistance at the regional level has been moderating somewhat. They do have a somewhat different approach. Instead of cap and trade, they have cap and imprison. I don't necessarily endorse that approach, but it seems to be some effectiveness in some regions, and they are beginning to shift. I put up just one illustrative statement by one of the policy leaders in China, saying it's in China's own interest to accept greenhouse gas emission goals, not just in the international interest. Unless we become one of the biggest green contributors, we will be one of the biggest victims of global warming. And, of course, President Hu and Premier Nguyen have themselves repeatedly made bold and even visionary statements on why China has to move quickly to limit the damage from global warming and to introduce renewable energy. Now, implementing that, executing those policies, that's a different story. But I think the basis for U.S.-Chinese cooperation in leading the world on this issue is certainly there, and I endorse your idea.
Last question, and then I'd just like to make one observation. But with respect to India and China, our mutual friend Vinod Khosla has talked about the electric solution being something that we can talk about here in the United States, but there's no electric solution in much of Africa, no electric solution in India, China, because they just don't have it, and they're not going to have it in the near term. So as they bring their combustion engines online, which they will as more and more Chinese, Indians, and others want to drive cars, what's your thought about how we approach the transportation sector in those countries with respect to global climate change standards?
Well, I wouldn't give up on electric vehicles in those areas, because central concentrated solar thermal generating systems actually can be introduced quickly and profitably in India, in the desert regions of the West, and connected by their own smart grid to areas where the electricity can be used. In Africa, I showed the slide earlier of the supergrid connecting northern Africa to western Europe. That can also provide electricity from the Sahel down into sub-Saharan Africa as well as demand grows. A line from the heavily insulated areas to Lagos, for example, to Nairobi, the potential is certainly there. Now, low-emission internal combustion vehicles will be introduced, but advanced biofuels made with cellulosic ethanol and some of the new technologies that sound like gobbledygook, enzymatic hydrolysis, some of the new approaches that really do offer the promise of making liquid biofuels from weedy plants that don't compete with food in ways that recycle the CO2 through the next year's crop, absent the processing cost, that does offer the hope for a more renewable, low-emitting advance in transportation infrastructure in these small countries.
Well, I thank you for that. And it's your belief, then, that you think that the solar can, in fact, be deployed rapidly enough in those countries?
I have no question about it at all.
I would just observe many people are in their reluctance to believe that we can embrace these goals as rapidly as many of us think we have to, need to recognize that the states are on their own way ahead of the federal government. And in fact, over half of the American economy is already voluntarily under mandatorily accepted reduction schemes. Specifically, in the Northeast, you have the REGI agreement, where they've actually promulgated regulations and are, on an interstate basis, engaged in mutual reductions. In the Midwest, there are 10 states, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Kansas, Ohio, and South Dakota, together with Manitoba, Canada, who have joined together in an effort to reduce. They have still to put out the regulations, but the important thing is they've agreed this has to be done and have been able to come to an agreement. As well as in the West, you have 5 states, Oregon, California, Washington, New Mexico, and Arizona. So more than half of the American economy has already done what Washington, D.C., and the federal government have been unwilling to do, which is to say we recognize this problem and we need to do something. I see you've put up you've come prepared for every component of this.
The latest count, this is of a couple of weeks ago. They may have added a few. But it's impressive that 884 cities have voluntarily adopted the central principles of the Kyoto Protocol. And even more impressive, what you cited, the state programs that actually start putting this into effect. And California has been leading the way, of course.
Right. Well, Mr. Vice President, I have to tell you, in the years I've been here, I've been to a lot of hearings. This is not because I'm chairing it, one of the most substantive and I think important messages that we've received in that time. And I've heard that already from my colleagues who are here. They are enormously appreciative of your presentation today. This is going to be a tough slug, but we're going to try to do it. We're going to do everything in our power to keep the pressure on and keep the focus on. But we are forever grateful to you for the power of your advocacy in this effort. We have nothing but enormous admiration and respect and gratitude for it. So thank you for sharing it with us today, and we look forward to working with you in the days to come.
Well, Senator Kerry, it's been my privilege to work as your partner for so many years on this, and thank you again, and thanks to the members of the committee for inviting me today.
We're delighted. Thank you. We stand adjourned.
That ends the question and answer session from the testimony of Al Gore to the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee on January 28, 2009. You can find Al Gore's testimony and the first part of this Q&A at ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org, in the Climate Solutions page. Just look for our audio on demand menu. Thanks for listening.